The inauguration of President Obama brought with it a new cabinet, including former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack, chosen by Obama to head the USDA. Vilsack was introduced by Chairman Tom Harkin to the Senate Ag Committee to be considered for confirmation.
I don't think President-elect Obama could have picked a better person for this position.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, Senator Chambliss, and members of the Committee of Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry for the opportunity and privilege to appear before you today. I particularly want to thank my fellow Iowans, the Chairman Tom Harkin and Senator Grassley, for their kind introduction, and Senator Chambliss for your kind remarks as well. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it is a great honor and privilege to be nominated by President-elect Barack Obama to lead the Department of Agriculture at this crucial time. The last Iowan asked to serve as Secretary of Agriculture was Henry Wallace. He served with extraordinary distinction during a period of historic challenge. And I am mindful of the high standard he set, the reforms he initiated, and the deep compassion he had for those who work our lands.
The Obama administration has proposed pieces of sweeping legislation, some of which remain on the table as 2009 ends. Climate change legislation has been discussed at length. The Copenhagen Climate Change Conference in December renewed debate on the proposal since an agreement was hammered out there in the late days of the conference. Those backing the president say the legislation is a step forward in preventing further change to the global shift in climate. Those against believe climate change legislation is the wrong approach and will only be a burden to agriculture. American Farm Bureau Chief Economist Bob Young is one of those saying that what's known as cap and trade is the wrong approach, which is echoed by the organization's president, Bob Stallman.
As we've looked at it, and a number of other folks have looked at it as well, the challenge that you end up with is if you allow offsets, we're going to talk about people taking land out of production, folks quitting agriculture and putting that land into trees, and shrinking agriculture. If you don't allow offsets, we're going to talk about increased production costs, and because of increased production costs, folks deciding to, you know, as in any economic model would tell you that when your revenues go down, you decide to produce a little bit less, folks decide to quit, and you shrink agriculture as well. So the bottom line is cap and trade, with or without offsets, will shrink agriculture in the United States. And is that the outcome that you want? And again, I wouldn't argue necessarily that there could be a substantial income stream for folks that decide to stop producing the food and fiber that you and I and the rest of the world need. Some estimates would say we'd take as much as 70 million acres of land out of production. I think the real question then becomes, do you like the agriculture you end up with at the end of the day? It'll be a much more brittle agriculture. It'll be much less resilient to short crop situations because you just wouldn't have the dirt to respond with. And that, I think, becomes the real question. Do you like what you end up with at the end of the day?
Well, the first thing we think would make it better is to do away with a mandatory cap and trade approach. That's nothing more than a hidden tax on American consumers. It's a hidden energy tax. We think a voluntary cap and trade program with moving forward with incentives, a renewable electricity standard, renewable fuel standard, more research into things like carbon capture and storage for the coal industry, more incentives and more funding to build nuclear, which is obviously a low-carbon fuel. We think a lot of things could be done to reduce carbon without putting a $200 billion a year tax on American consumers.
Just as it is with many other issues, opinions about cap and trade, opinions about climate change legislation differ. Dennis Nuxall is Director of Federal Policy and Government Relations with American Farmland Trust. He tells Brownfield's Bob Meyer agriculture can benefit from climate change legislation, and a recent study from Kansas State University confirms that.
What the folks at Kansas State did is they looked at all of those studies, in essence, for producers. And what they found that on the cost side of the equation, there are going to be increased costs as a result of climate change legislation, but those costs are less than 6% consistently across all of the studies. So you have single-digit cost increases for commodity and livestock as a result of a clean energy bill. And that's very consistent across all of the analysis that has been done to date by universities across the country. So on the cost side, that's very clear. On the benefit side, they said, listen, depending on how these opportunities are structured and depending on how producers capture those opportunities, there is the potential for producers to actually earn new streams of income from offsets, from renewable energy, and those new streams of income have the potential to not only make up for any cost increases, but in fact earn producers more money than they would get absent the legislation itself.
It cannot be underestimated the degree of frustration among mostly cattle producers with government proposals to institute a national animal identification system. Unhappiness over the proposals differs depending upon the region of the country, but it's obvious that cattlemen in some parts of the country are adamantly opposed to NAICS, N-A-I-S. Brownfield's Julie Harker witnessed the angst firsthand.
In the first half of 2009, U.S. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack announced the U.S. Department of Agriculture would hold listening sessions throughout the country on the USDA's five-year-old controversial National Animal Identification System, or NAIS. The turnout for these sessions was so strong and the demand from producers to have their voices heard so great that more sessions were added in more states. Producers and other participants had 3 minutes each to go on record and state their views. Very few spoke in favor of a mandatory animal ID system. The vast majority were either adamantly against it or in favor of a voluntary ID system only. This Texas farmer, who's a member of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance, an anti-NAIS group, owns a few goats. Like many, he expressed fears that if the NAIS were to become mandatory, it would give the government too much control.
If I got to sign up for this NAIS, I don't feel like I own anything anymore. The government owns everything, and I'm just like the slave that's there to take care of everything, and if you screw up, they're going to throw you in the brig.
Fifth-generation Texas rancher Hatch Smith favors a voluntary ID system.
I like to let markets take care of it. If my cattle are worth more identified than not identified, then I can make that decision to identify them.
If a producer wants to raise and market radio ID'd, age and source verified livestock, that's okay with Smith. And he says he doesn't hold to the conspiracy theories about NAIS that others who testified against it do.
I think corporate agriculture businesses are good for the country. They feed 300 million people. We're not going to feed them all with our free-range chickens. But if you want to raise free-range chickens and you have a market for it, that's great. Everybody has their own niche.
Questions remain about how effective NAIS would be, even with full producer participation. Josh Weingartner with the Texas Cattle Feeders Association says a mandatory ID system is the goal.
We would like to see a system in place that would allow us to easily and quickly trace back a diseased animal. The fear out there is that we get a foreign animal disease that emerges in an animal and that it's spread through the chain. An animal goes to a cell barn and infects cattle there and then goes to a feed yard and potentially infects cattle there. We want to be able to find that animal quickly, trace it back to its origin to ensure that there aren't other contagious animals. Without a system like that, we run the risk of killing our export markets and our domestic markets as well.
In the Jefferson City, Missouri NAIS listening session, there was only one person who spoke in favor of mandatory animal ID, a pork producer, and he was booed off the stage. Rhonda Perry, who has an 80-head cow-calf operation, represents the 5,600 members of the Missouri Rural Crisis Center. She says there's plenty else the USDA could be doing to help cattle producers besides an onerous national animal ID system. For one thing, she says, USDA must address the area of competition.
We can talk about the industry and how we're going to compete in this global market, but we can't compete unless there is real competition in the livestock markets. That's a role for USDA and one that you could play right now today. We also think we need to have real inspections and USDA oversight at slaughter plants. We have had a major breakdown. We've got to stop the imports of livestock from countries that have known health diseases. We have got to regulate the industrial livestock operations that are creating havoc in rural communities. And finally, we really believe we need to put our resources into maintaining and supporting the disease control programs that have worked. Those are the programs that have a proven effectiveness. Those are the programs that we need to support, maintain, and improve if necessary, instead of looking at this unproven, ineffective, anti-farmer, corporate-driven program of NAIS.
At the 14th and final NAIS listening session just outside of Omaha in late June, one of the major objections was confidentiality. The president of the Iowa Cattlemen's Association said it was a big concern with his group's members that under a Freedom of Information Act request, USDA cannot guarantee that the animal ID database could be protected. But Michael Kelsey, executive vice president of the Nebraska Cattlemen's Organization, says his group supports having disease surveillance held and controlled by private industry for the protection of producer information. He said since disease surveillance is the reason for an animal ID system, there's no reason for government to control the data or for producer information to be made available to companies, groups, or individuals. A few weeks after the NAIS listening sessions came to an end, the House Agriculture Appropriations Committee voted to eliminate all funding for NAIS, and in August, their Senate committee counterpart voted to slash funding for NAIS in half. By the time the 2010 Ag Appropriations Bill passed, NAIS funding was reduced to just over $5 million without specifics on how those funds would be spent. By the conclusion of 2009, no word from the USDA on whether it would take NAIS from voluntary status to mandatory. I'm Julie Harker.
Biodiesel depends on tax incentives to remain viable. Without them, biodiesel interests say the industry cannot exist. They're set to expire. The House agreed that they should be extended, but the Senate has yet to act. Biodiesel interests are also keenly aware of rule changes proposed for the Renewable Fuel Standard, or RFS2, the new rules governing the increase in mandated ethanol and biodiesel usage. The year is finished with still no formal announcement about the implementation of RFS2. Although renewable fuels interests are all for increasing usage, the proposed rules for RFS2 did not fail to disappoint. National Biodiesel Board CEO Joe Jobe explains the rule's controversial land use study.
The EPA used the period of 2001 to 2004 looking at worldwide land conversion from forest or fallow land or something into cropland. And they tried to calculate CO2 based on that land conversion and then attribute all of that to soy biodiesel and then extrapolate that CO2 increase to 100 years going forward and then extrapolate that back to how much CO2 would be caused by U.S. soy biodiesel. Those are just extraordinarily huge assumptions to make because just looking, there was very little soy biodiesel, U.S. soy biodiesel sold in the period from 2001 to 2004. And so to assume that soy biodiesel was the driver for that land conversion is just ludicrous. But when you look at the period from 2005 to 2008, when there was a lot of soy biodiesel produced, and look, for example, at the acres of soy in Brazil, stayed flat during that time period. So there's significant evidence that biodiesel and U.S. biodiesel policy is not a driving factor in terms of international land conversion.
Joe Jobe is the chief executive officer of the National Biodiesel Board. Politics and regulations were the least of troubles in some cases for renewable fuels in 2009. It was a year of bankruptcies and restructuring in the ethanol industry. Bob Meyer.
The rise and fall of the largest ethanol company in the country was indicative of what the industry went through. At its peak in 2008, Virasun Energy owned 16 ethanol plants in the United States with 1.6 billion gallons of annual capacity. Like many ethanol producers, the rising price of oil, the rising price of corn, prompted them to lock in a lot of that corn. And then the economy fell. Oil prices fell, ethanol prices fell, and suddenly plants were holding a lot of very expensive corn, not to mention financing based upon those stronger ethanol prices. President and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association, Bob Dineen, says he is glad the past is behind him.
There's a light at the end of the tunnel, and we don't hear the train coming at us. So our industry is feeling a lot better about things. You know, look, the whole nation's economy was suffering over the last 18 months. And as, you know, we're not going to be immune from that. But as the economy turns around, as demand picks up, certainly our industry is recovering as well. And that's a good thing. Profitability is returning to the industry. $80 a barrel of oil certainly, makes profitability that much easier. And it also points to the reason why we need to have more ethanol, because it's without it, without ethanol being 8% of the nation's motor fuel today, blended in 80% of the nation's gasoline, you know, gasoline oil prices would be that much higher. So we are turning around and look forward to the future.
One ray of hope for the industry in 2009 was the renewable fuel standard, in hopes that the EPA would increase the blend rate for ethanol from the current 10% per gallon to 15% per gallon. But the agency put that decision off until probably June of 2010. Tom Bias with Growth Energy, the group that made the request, is optimistic about that decision when it comes.
Moving to E15 is really important because, one, it sends a signal that there is market space for people who want to invest in cellulosic ethanol. You know, we've certainly with the RFS at 36 billion gallons, for us to get to that level as a nation, we're going to have to move in that direction. But it's pretty tough to get investment into it when there's no market space, and there's no market space because of the blend wall.
In the meantime, ethanol plants continue to struggle. On December 21st, Hawkeye Renewables, a subsidiary of the largest ethanol producer in Iowa, filed for Chapter 11 protection. I'm Bob Meyer.
We found out in 2009 that there are more Americans struggling with not having enough food. Brownfield's Julie Harker tells us about a USDA report in 2009 showing the highest rate of food insecurity since reporting began nearly 15 years ago.
The Economic Research Service study shows that during 2008, 17 million U.S. households, that's 49 million people, were food insecure, and families had difficulty putting enough food on the table at times during the year. It's an increase of 4 million households from 2007. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack says well over a million children are included in that number.
I think this report suggests that it is time for America to get very serious about food security and hunger, about nutrition, and about food safety. This, together with several other reports that have been issued in the last couple of weeks by USDA, are a wake-up call for America.
Vilsack says it's time to build on what's already been done in the 2009 Recovery Act, which provided more nutrition assistance benefits and is geared toward long-term job creation. But Vilsack says his message to the Senate Ag Committee today will be,
our best has not been good enough.
The committee takes up the extended reauthorization of nutrition programs at schools. I'm Julie Harker.
Activists keep trying to pass ballot issues to restrict animal agriculture, but their task will be more difficult in Ohio. It's been a long and late harvest. We'll hear experts' opinions about market direction, and we'll reflect on the life of Norman Borlaug. That's when we return. You're listening to Brownfield's 2009 Year in Review.